Good morning. I'm Tommy Howe, and welcome to another edition of Tree Huggers International from the studios of KBZT, FM 94.9 in San Diego. Tree Huggers International is a weekly natural science and environmental affairs program dedicated to the preservation of parks, wildlands, and special places from the beaches to the mountains to the deserts. This is Tree Huggers International. Be careful and use this show with caution, because you might just learn something. After years of neglect, cut-to-the-bone budgets, and a growing backlog of needed projects and necessary maintenance, our nation's national parks are finally on the receiving end of some needed funds. And as our nation begins to reinvest in our national parks, public awareness about the value of national parks has also increased over the past year, thanks in no small part to the recent Ken Burns documentary on the history of our national parks on PBS. While it's hard to imagine we'll be returning to the days where presidents camped with conservationists the way President Theodore Roosevelt did with John Muir at Yosemite, Americans are making an effort to see their parks again. From the national battlefield sites in the east, to the Great Smoky Mountains and the Shenandoah Valley in Acadia, to the truly stunning natural monuments of Yellowstone, the Grand Canyon, the Tetons, Mount Rainier, Glacier, Crater Lake, and Yosemite. Internationally renowned conservationist and outdoor photographer Ian Shive is celebrating the natural heritage of America's national parks, and he's not waiting for the National Park Service's centennial in 2016 to do so. He's celebrating it now with a new book called The National Parks, Our American Landscape. Illustrated with Ian's photographs, the book features an introduction from Tom Kiernan, the president of the National Parks Conservation Association, and includes essays by the NPCA's National Parks editors who detail their experiences of collaborating with Ian Shive in their Washington offices and in the field. But the star of the book are the photos taken by Ian Shive for the NPCA and other outlets, and we are extremely fortunate to have him here with us in the studio today. Ian Shive, welcome to Tree Huggers International.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
The centennial of the National Park Service is coming up in 2016,
but
I gather you weren't interested in waiting around that long to put this book out.
Well, you know, I actually was initially, and that was kind of the funny thing about the book. I wanted to put something together in 2016, figuring I'd have 5 or 6 years to just go and get everything absolutely perfect, completely mastered. And I realized that I had several years of images, and I was starting to see the national parks in a way that nobody had really ever seen them before. Being on assignment for NPCA, they'd sent me up onto the slopes of Mount McKinley and Denali National Park. I got to go out in the water in Lake Mead with the Submerged Resources Group, and they'd see, you know, B-52 bomber that crashed in the Cold War era. And I started seeing all these things in very unique ways. And I said, all right, well, I'd love to do a book. And I sent out some emails, tried to get support from NPCA and some other conservation groups, and nobody even wrote me back. And I said, well, 2016 would be great. Didn't hear anything. Find out the email gets passed around, lands at a publisher in Northern California who emails me, says, we love your images. We think the market's ready for a book now. What do you think? Can you put one together in 4 months? And so I started to take a hard look at what I had, and I realized I had a great wealth of images there. And so I hope to actually do one for the centennial as well, but it was a great time to put one together now.
This is the primer.
Yeah.
And that outfit is Palace Publishing, correct?
That's right, yeah.
You know, we all have our favorite places and favorite parks to hike and climb at, but can you name a few national parks or monuments you particularly enjoy doing your photography at?
Yeah, you know, parks, I think, are all, they're very personal. I think everybody relates to certain ones different ways. I mean, there's one in, if there's not an actual park like a Yosemite, there's a historic site, maybe there's Gettysburg or something like that. And I think people relate to those depending on where they are regionally. For me, Yellowstone National Park was, I went to college up in Bozeman, in Montana, and you know, and I say went to college, I use that term very loosely because I was pretty much always in Yellowstone.
You were in Bozeman.
I wasn't academically successful. That's right. You go there to ski and backpack. You don't go there for education. And so I spent a lot of time up there. And it is, you know, the first national park. And so ironically, you know, it's kind of funny to have that as being a special place for me. But, you know, these days I spend a lot of time in the Channel Islands because it's close to home. I live in L.A. And so going out to the islands, it's quick. I can get in the water in the middle of the day. I can catch sunset at night. So I've really enjoyed spending time out there.
And Channel Islands National Park, that is still very wild.
It is very wild. They don't get a lot of visitors. You know, it's also very new. There's a lot of different parts and pieces that have been added over the years. I think as recently as I think the mid '80s was the last time a big piece has been added. But they got other the Nature Conservancy owns 73%, I think, of Santa Cruz Island, and there's still a lot of litigation going on with Santa Rosa Island. So it's still very much a park in the works, as many parks are.
Which parks continue to surprise you or enchant you in ways you weren't expecting?
Big Bend National Park is by far the one that blew me away. Cool. I roll in at like high noon. The sun's coming down. It's boring. The light's flat. And I'm like, this is a desert. It's a desert park. There's nothing. It's not like, you know, Joshua Tree. You get the rock formations. You pull in. You got the Joshua Trees. You pull into Big Bend at first, and especially if it's at the wrong time of day and there's nothing that special about it. But then after 7 or 8 days being on assignment, I saw my first and only mountain lion in the wild out there. The Chisos Mountains just light up orange at sunset. Tarantulas come out, badgers, there's natural hot springs. And it's an international park. I mean, it used to be. Now, of course, with the border closure, a lot of that's been kind of ruined, more or less. But it's still spectacular. You get the Rio Grande flowing through it all. And so that was a place that over time really unraveled for me. And it was really, it was just beautiful.
Did you find the people in that part of Texas really loved their national park? Do you find they really made efforts to get out there a lot?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've spent a lot of time in Texas doing photography and conservation, ironically. And I tell you, I haven't met a Texan I never liked. they're fantastic people. It's been always a good experience. They take you in. I've literally had people who've set me up in their homes while I'm out shooting down there. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And they're very proud of their parks and of their wild lands, and especially along the border, which is kind of a tenuous place.
The Big Bend is one of the classics, too. That was set aside in the 40s, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it is. It's been around for a while. And you know, I guess it's ranked kind of one of the more popular places, which I'm surprised because it's not an easy place to get to. It's not like, I guess none of the parks are terribly easy to get to, the big ones. The Yellowstones, Yosemite, all of them you got to go for a 4 or 5 hour drive usually. But Big Bend's no exception, especially being so far down there in the south.
So how long did it take you to amass this volume of images?
Well, it's about 4 years worth of images. It's the oldest image, ironically, is the cover of the book of the Snake River Overlook, which is kind of cool because that same spot was shot by Ansel Adams. It's a classic view. But what's cool is you can actually see in his picture the trees are all miniaturized, and the island in the middle is still dirt and rock. And in my picture, it's all come to life. There's a lot of green, and the trees have grown. And I've been back, since it's the oldest picture, it was shot 4 years ago, I've actually been back, and most of the river is now completely obscured. So like anything, all the national parks are changing. And so it's probably one of the freshest looks at the parks, too. I would say the great majority of the images, 75% of them, are shot in the last 2 years.
You know, you mentioned Ansel Adams. I mean, over the past 4 years, have you done any work in black and white?
I haven't really, no. I'm the son of a photographer, and I grew up making black and white prints. That was actually one of the first things that really struck me. I remember being a kid, like 5 or 6 years old. I'm in my dad's darkroom. Can still remember the smell of the chemicals, of course. And I remember the first time you see an image. I don't think anybody ever forgets that, when you see a picture of a face or a place suddenly show up on this white, empty sheet of paper that's just sitting in what looks like a bath of water. And it's magic. And to me, that kind of struck me. And having the book out, I've talked to a lot of people, and a lot of people ask me a lot of questions. And I never really thought about a lot of this stuff, but I've started to deconstruct my process and my evolution as a photographer, and so it's really, really kind of interesting. But the black and white darkroom is definitely where it began, but it's never really been a direction for me. I love the color image.
Yeah, because Ansel Adams, he wasn't so sure about color, and he experimented with it, but of course
it was early.
He's known for his black and white.
Yeah, well, it was early, too. I mean, he pushed black and white. I mean, he reprinted a lot of black and white images that maybe he shot 20 years before. He'd reprint them with new technology, new papers, new printing chemicals and processes to kind of further constantly refine his vision for what he wanted the image to be. I think color images, I've seen his color images quite a bit, and there's, I think, even a new book on them. But the film wasn't really that punchy. I think there was a lot of lack of control, I think, at that time, and so you're pretty limited to what the film could do.
Are you a film purist, or do you like digital?
No, I love digital. I'm not really a purist in the sense of saying, oh, I want it to be. I don't add or subtract anything from my pictures. I think that there's a certain degree of ethics that you have to have when you're trying to represent wilderness, especially when you're trying to do it from an advocacy standpoint. You don't want to suddenly add a sky or make it look extra And frankly, I think most people can usually peg a fake photo anyway, but you don't want to fake something that you're then trying to say, here, this is why we should save it, you know, and then you're adding a wolf or something in the foreground. So that to me kind of defeats the purpose, but I'm also not a purist. I think digital's awesome. I think we got to embrace that kind of stuff. And you know, a lot of magazines and places that used to be the first organizations to embrace change are now the last. And so I find the digital revolution is something that's being led more by people and on the internet, certainly, than it is by magazines and editorial outlets.
And they tend to prefer photographs shot on film?
Well, they do digital, but they'll make you give them your files without you doing any of the correcting, which is really a big part of a digital photographer's process. I don't add or subtract anything, but you know, there's a way I put my levels, there's a contrast. It's just the same way you get to choose your own film. It'd be like somebody else choosing your film for you. If you prefer to use Fuji and somebody else says, well, you're going to use Kodak, you get two different results with that. It's kind of the same idea. I like a certain degree of contrast. I like a certain degree of saturation. It's pretty consistent. I almost use the same settings across the board on my images. That's pretty much how I would liken it. And so I find that you end up giving somebody your files. It's no longer really all your photography.
Who are some of your favorite photographers? Do you have any?
I do. You know, most of my photography is actually influenced by painters. I actually love painters. Georgia O'Keeffe, Andrew Wyeth, huge fans of those two in particular. Van Gogh, I always like the bold lines, the outlines on things. Again, kind of going to my idea of I like contrast. For photographers, as a kid, I had a Jim Brandenburg wolf poster on my wall that now I recognize as a Jim Brandenburg. Back then, it was a cool wolf poster. And I've always loved his images a lot. I think he just really connects with the landscape and has that emotional response that's needed, I think, to make beautiful images.
Well, talk to me about your experience at Denali National Park, because you wound up accompanying a search and rescue team on Mount McKinley.
Yeah, it was one of the most intense experiences of my life.
Wasn't what you signed up for.
No, it wasn't. And I didn't really know. And frankly, it's a bad way to go into anything, I think. You're supposed to go in prepared, especially when you're going into a situation where you're responsible for other people's lives. You're tied into the guy in front of you, tied into the guy behind you. I was prepared in the sense that I'd been up high, I'd done a lot of climbing, but, you know, it was pushing me to a new level. Plus, I was there to take pictures. I was there to tell a story. I was embedded in a search and rescue team with a bunch of guys. There were six of us total. We had three United States Air Force pararescue guys. These guys, they jumped out of helicopters in Afghanistan, Iraq, did Katrina rescue in the middle of winter. They're jumping and pulling fishermen out of the Bering Sea. And in their downtime, they climb Mount McKinley, the highest peak in North America. And so I got these guys on my team. I've got a cardiothoracic surgeon specializing in wilderness medicine, the lead climbing ranger on McKinley. And then there's me. And I'm like, I'm afraid I'm going to be that guy on the team, you know? And it was really intense because it's basically a slow walk uphill. But you're breathing oxygen, 50% less oxygen up at the elevation we're working at. And we're higher than, to give you an idea, people hear, 14,000 feet isn't that high. You know, mountain goes all the way up to the 20s. But 14,000 feet is 1,000 feet higher than where people jump out of airplanes when they go parachuting. They do that around 13,000 feet. And so you're up there sucking air and trying to stay in a very small area because you can't leave. You're on an active glacier. It moves a foot every day. You've got crevasses that are – the glacier's a mile deep. When you drop a waste bag down there, you never hear it hit the bottom. It's that deep. Well, you're skiing on that, and you could fall through on a false bridge or snow bridge. So you've got all of the challenges of – mountaineering, and then you're, like I said, you're there to tell a story too. So it was a brilliant experience. I mean, to see that and to be up there, and Mount McKinley's the who's who of mountaineering too. Peter Hillary, Sir Edmund Hillary's son, was up there doing the last of eight summits. I got to cook him dinner. I still had responsibilities. We all had to take turns cooking mashed potatoes and whatever else, but it was pretty awesome.
It's a very intimate thing when you rope in.
It is.
Team.
It is. Yeah. And I knew I was with a good crew, and I still talk to all those guys, and you bond. And I'm not a military guy, but I understood what that kind of camaraderie was. It gave me a real taste of what it meant when you're out there in a situation where your life is dependent on the guy next to you and vice versa. And it's almost like people bond, I guess, in traumatic situations. It's kind of a similar situation. You're in a very intense environment, which, by the way, it's a lot of boredom. As one guy described it, he says it's boredom with moments of sheer terror. That's what that experience is like.
talk to me about when you were at Lake Mojave at Lake Mead National Recreation Area in Nevada.
Yeah, that was a great experience. I mean, they've all been great experiences. They're all very unique. Each one is very the group of people are different. These were underwater archaeologists. They're a submerged resources group, and they were the thing that really put them on the map was this B-52 bomber that disappeared during the Cold War era. Was flying low, they think probably horsing around more or less with this bomber, hit the top of the water somewhere and disappeared. And it was gone for 50-plus years, I think. And it was newly discovered. They found it, this group, at the very bottom. I think it was 180 feet down. But, you know, the one thing that's interesting about Lake Mead is with the drying of the West that's going on, it's 85 feet low. So that 185 feet of water was now only 100 feet of water. So it became suddenly more accessible. And that's something that's interesting for those guys because this crew really was starting to see new archaeological finds because of the low water levels. For the first time, these levels have been so low, they're finding settlements from early man settlements along the shores and things like that that they had no idea were there before. And it's opening up a whole new Pandora's box of geology. And so it's really cool. So I got to spend a lot of time out there with them. I spent not a huge amount of time. It was about 3 or 4 days. We were out on the boats. We were out in the water diving with them. And you know, I'm amazed because it's windy. And when they open the reservoir, the boat's rocking. and you're out there you know, with your dive gear on. And I shoot underwater. So I've got dive housings and stuff like that. So once again, it's kind of you know an environment where you're out there. You're completely out of your element a little bit. You're not only doing what they're doing, but then you're also trying to tell that story of what they're doing, too.
If you're just joining us, this is Tree Huggers International, broadcast from the studios of KBZT, FM 94.9 in San Diego. I'm Tommy Howe, and we're joined in the studio today by photographer Ian Shive, whose new book from Palace Publishing, The National Parks, Our American Landscape, celebrates the glory of our nation's national parks and will hopefully encourage and remind our elected officials to better appreciate the special duty they have overseeing these wonderful places for the citizenry of the U.S. and hopefully encourages more people to strap on a pair of boots and get out there and go see these amazing examples of America's natural heritage. And Ian, we're going to talk more about your new media entity, Wild Collective, in just a moment, but the website for it is wildcollective.com.
Correct.
That's www.wildcollective.com. Also, your own website and blog, that's at www.ianshive.com. That's I-A-N-S-H-I-V-E, ianshive.com.
Yep.
Did you grow up in a household or a place where outdoor values were valued, or did you really start getting into that when you got to Bozeman?
It developed in Bozeman. I grew up in New Jersey, and I grew up in Central Jersey, which wasn't like the New Jersey people fly into New York City, and they say, oh, God, that's New Jersey, and that's the bad rap that the state gets. But I grew up in a really kind of rural part of the state, and it was beautiful. And I grew up with values that my parents were really believed in, you know, spending time outdoors. And I think not only from families that spend time together outdoors and hike and do that, I think it's real good for them. And my parents recognized that from an early age. I remember being a kid and, you know, sometimes just going to the park. I mean, I grew up going to parks and looking at salamanders and ducks. I wasn't looking at B-52 bombers. I was looking at little things, but I remember it to this day. And I got tons of pictures of me, you know, rolling around in leaves and going places. And, you know, we weren't wealthy people. We couldn't go all over the country and see the Yellowstones. But you know, as I got older, my parents did. We went to Grand Canyon first. It was the first time I was 14 years old. And then we went to Montana up to Yellowstone next the following year. And so the parks really started to become on my radar, which is how, in truth, it was really how I chose Montana as my destination because I knew I wanted to do film at one point. I figured my career was going to be in the film industry, which it kind of all is. It all kind of comes around in a way. But I knew I'd probably end up in either New York or L.A. And I said, this is my chance to change it up. Go someplace completely different. Get out of Jersey. Get out of New York. I'll see you California soon, which I've been here now for 12 years. And I went to Montana. And so there it just developed. And I was there at a really interesting time because the wolves had just been reintroduced to Yellowstone. It was the year the wolves got reintroduced. So that was just – it was explosive. And so I didn't just arrive. I mean, I got there and it was just – people were protesting outside the parks. It was all sorts of things that were going on.
And now the wolves have been taken off the endangered species list, which is another whole conversation.
That's a debacle going on up there. Yeah,
it is.
It's a mess.
the National Parks Conservation Association recently posted a video called Renewing Our National Park Promise featuring your images. That was done in conjunction with Wild Collective?
Yeah. There were some other people's images as well, and it was a piece that we produced. Wild Collective is a company that kind of bore out of the idea. When I was first putting this book together, I had to pick up shots that I didn't have. And I needed to go, and I'd seen all these unique things, like I said, but I didn't have. I kind of skipped over. Think about it. I was in college in Montana. I never had a shot of Old Faithful. So you're doing a book on the national parks. You got to have a few of the icons. So I had to go back and do this. And so I had about a 7,500-mile road trip to the American West I put together for about a three-week period or so. And I decided that I wasn't going to just go and photograph it. I'm going to bring a guy who's a friend and a filmmaker, and he brought an HD broadcast camera and filmed the whole process. And from that, we got back thinking, okay, we'll do a five-minute piece, put it on the web, right? Be a good marketing tool. We get back, we have 36 hours of footage. And it's beautiful footage. And we're sitting there looking at it, saying, okay, this isn't a five-minute piece. Let's do 4 5-minute pieces. So we start putting it together into this regional thing. And then from there, it grew out to the idea of and it was so different. And that was the point. And that's kind of the point of what Wild Collective is in general, is to reach new audiences, to get into a new demographic. And one of the things that I've been a big advocate for is the national parks are aging, not only as the people who spend a lot of time in them, the average age. A lot of the average age of these nonprofit groups, the stewards of the national parks, is in their 70s. You know, why not get people, I mean, young kids, 18, 20-year-olds. I loved the parks as a 20-year-old when I got to college. You know, as a late teen, it's like, why not bring that audience in? And I think a big part of that is a huge disconnect. And I want to fill that hole. I want to fill that disconnect with what I think is the web. I think is one of the greatest tools, because who's not on it?
Do you feel a lot of that disconnect has been replaced by this idea that the outdoors are something to be conquered? That whole extreme
sure.
sports idea.
Yeah.
Whereas you can't just go out and just enjoy it for what it is. You somehow have to triumph over it.
Yeah. Well, that's the whole man versus wild. I mean, it's a classic example. You know, we have a lot of programming out there in general that is fear-based, most dangerous, fill in the blank, right?
Yeah.
Man overcoming this. And it is a mentality. I think that's been for a very long period of time. And what's interesting about the parks themselves is from a conservation standpoint, they were created. Yellowstone and Yosemite were the first two land masses that were ever put aside, ever, in human history, so that future generations could see it just the way it is now. And that was at a time when the West was an open frontier. It was completely unexplored. They didn't have urban sprawl. They didn't have overcrowding. That worked then. That was a great idea because they knew. I mean, the amount of foresight in that was just awesome. But what's happened now is we've created islands of conservation. The national parks are islands. They've got four walls, and we're building right up to the edge of them. On my way up to Yosemite about a week and a half ago, massive casino that's right out there. It's on Native American land.
I know exactly where that is, too.
Yeah.
And that's huge.
Huge.
It's like a palace.
Yeah, it looks like one. I mean, it looks like you're driving into Dubai. I mean, it's
yeah.
unbelievable. It's a monolith. And it's just a shame to me because there's nothing wrong with what we did, and I think we did it exactly the way it needed to be done. But now we need to continue to grow and adapt, and that's something that I'm really trying to promote through the web and through a lot of these projects, is that, you know, conservation isn't something that can be walled in with four sides. I feel like it's something that needs to be a lifestyle. Mm-hmm. It's the way we live. It's to have contiguous things. It's the fact that our air quality in L.A. affects the Grand Canyon and affects these other wild places. You know, Great Smoky Mountains have something like 30 days that were declared toxic for humans to be in, yeah. for breathing, because the air quality was so bad. It was ridiculous. Imagine that. You can't breathe air in a national park. And, of course, none of that's coming from right in that area. It's coming from all these other places, sometimes thousands of miles away, 1,000 miles away in the country. So
a lot of that haze from the San Joaquin Valley and all the agricultural work going on there winds up affecting Sequoia, Kings Canyon, Yosemite.
Yep, exactly. And then, of course, the coal-powered plants. That's the other big thing that's putting a lot of air quality issues in the parks and having a big impact on that. But, you know, there is a shift. And we're at a great time, I think, and it continues to be challenging, and there's for a lot of reasons. You know, with climate change as being a real, very contentious thing. You know, and my whole position in general is I don't want to be a fear-based type of advocate for the environment. I want to be somebody that shows you, look how great it is, and I figure if I can show you it, like you said, get somebody to put their boots on and get out there and experience it, they're going to make their own decisions. They're going to make a smart decision and say, you know what, this is awesome. This is something I want to go and try and do something better. I want to be smarter about the way I live. And I think that through inspiration, I think you're going to get more of an active movement towards these things.
It is the quickest way to get someone to change their mind or begin thinking about something they never thought of before is take them someplace amazing.
Yeah,
it's true. I took a friend of mine from the Midwest to Mount Rainier, and he has not been the same ever since then.
Yeah.
And you're working with Al Gore's Current TV.
That's right.
Now, is that in conjunction with Wild Collective?
Yeah, it is. It was kind of part of the all of the evolution of those four pieces that we created to promote the book and then kind of just get into a younger audience. We shared them with the talent executives over at Current, and then they brought it into the programming guys and ended up becoming a television pitch meeting. And the next thing you know, they're like, yeah, let's put this on the air and get it out there. So it airs a couple times, I think, a day very often. I know I was on Virgin America flying across the country, and they had it two or three times. I was on my way back from D.C. to L.A. and got to see it on there. I'm like, what a great audience. You know, it's just a cool airline. It's great to have that, and Current's been really you know, they have a good demographic, too. I think it was like an 18 to 34 demo. So not only were we doing the web thing, but we were getting it on television sets, too. So that was really great.
Wild Collective also produced this piece called A Call of the Wild.
Yeah. You know, what's happened is there's I want to make the difference of a nature photographer and a conservation photographer. A nature photographer is somebody who goes out and does the exact same thing I do as far as what pictures they take. A conservation photographer, somebody who takes those images and then uses them to go into action, to become an advocate and make a difference. And so that's something that I've been continuing to do in my partnership with the National Parks Conservation Association, NPCA. And I had the really great opportunity to speak at the U.S. Capitol about 2 weeks ago. And they invited me down to speak about my experiences and how I saw the parks from Alaska to Florida to Maine to California, and how I saw climate change affecting them. And I figured it was not only should I show photographs, but let's do what we do and make a short film. So we made this 3-minute piece, which really was brilliant. I got to show it to John Jarvis, the head of the National Park Service, was there, who I absolutely love. Got to sit down, talk to this guy for 15, 20 minutes. I think he's going to do a great job.
He finally got confirmed,
exactly. But you know what he said is the Call of the Wild is a poem by Robert Service. And he hit the nail on the head. He goes, when I saw that on the car ride over, him and the lead climate guy, the director of climate for the Park Service, said, the parks are part poetry and part science, and that's where they meet. And the fact that we opened with this Robert Service poem was we hit the nail on the head, and it just really resonated with him, and they really loved it. And then I got into some specific examples of what I saw as climate change, and you know, it wasn't like saying there were 20 glaciers and now there's 10. My stuff was very anecdotal, and I think that everybody really related to that.
Well, and one of the pieces you did for a Wild Exposure was about Glacier National
Park. That's right.
And there's been a lot of attention paid to that because
yep.
of the vanishing glaciers. I mean.
Yep.
Folks aren't making this stuff up.
Yeah,
these really are vanishing.
Yeah, that's kind of one of the best indicator parks I think there are is Glacier National Park. Not just because of the glaciers, they've actually also got which obviously they're very visible. You can count them and say here there's less, but there's other things that are very obvious to the people who go there and spend a lot of time. Biologists. I spent a month up there last summer hiking on the trails with somebody who'd spent 40 years of their life there. Biologist, veteran writer of National Geographic. And what they're seeing is mountain goats and pika, these little fuzzy, they're basically fuzzy barometers. They actually fall over when they get too hot. They die. They just fall over and die. They don't have the ability to adapt like other creatures. They're going higher and higher. And most people think of Glacier National Park as one of the highest places in the world, right? So what happens when they run out of square footage, which they already have? They're at the tops of these mountain peaks. And so you start to see this migration up. And that's another clear sign that there's definitely something going on. Another very clear example was a Native American woman that I was up there to photograph. Actually, she was the last of a handful of elders who spoke her native tongue. And so she was actually trying to preserve it in recordings. She was 87 years old. And it was the coolest experience to meet her. She'd lived on this land her entire life. Her 1,000 years worth of ancestors had lived on the same part of land outside Glacier National Park.
It's the Blackfoot Reservation?
It is. It's the Blackfoot Kootenai Tunaha Reservation. And she didn't just talk about her language, but she started telling stories. And she talked about how the trees in winter, when she was a kid, and they would talk about it because they had a whole Native American story that went with it. They would crack in the middle of the night in the cold winter. They're like a thunder. The tree would split because of all the water and the moisture in them would freeze very suddenly in the cold because it's one of the coldest parts of the continental United States. And she doesn't hear that anymore. Mm. And so that it was those kind of anecdotes where, you know, the drying of the West, the lack of water, and how these types of things that have been there for thousands of years and had stories and tales to go with them are now only going to be stories. There's going to be nothing left. So, you know, those kinds of things are the kinds of things I was very fortunate to share at the Capitol, and I hope it comes across to somebody.
I have one last photography-related question.
Yeah, sure.
For you. Because you mentioned earlier, you mentioned that great iconic view of the Tetons with the Snake River flowing in the foreground. How do you go and photograph these vistas, like Bridal Veil Falls,
right,
or the Merced River going through Yosemite Valley, or Mount Rainier, that these images that you could argue are in the American collective consciousness? We've seen these images. We've digested them. We understand
it's
them.
All been there, yeah.
What do you like to do to sort of maybe take those vistas and those visuals and make them a little different without giving away too many of your secrets?
I'll give away all my secrets. I don't care. I'm all about it. You know, when it's the classic spots, it's really about just spending time and thinking about it and really trying to think about how can you change something like that. And each place is very different. You know, Old Faithful, I tried to photograph at night with the stars and get the long stream of water. And that got completely ruined because they built up so many buildings around Old Faithful for the tourism industry. That the glow of the lights made Old Faithful look like it was like a water show at the Bellagio in Vegas. It was horrible. It was orange and green and stuff. So, you know, you've got all new challenges that Ansel Adams didn't have to deal with when he was photographing Old Faithful. But you know, usually I spend a lot of time kind of moving around. I get out on foot. I don't drive, just drive the roads. I usually walk. I get out and I walk. I hike. I climb. I dive. I swim. I've got underwater images in Glacier National Park. People think of the highest mountains, the crown of the continent. They don't think of underwater. You know, try and just be completely unique. But the other thing is, so much of, I think, good photography isn't necessarily about what you're capturing as far as the landscape. Maybe it's El Capitan. It's actually going and seeing a moment that, if you only were there, that's the only time you'd be able to see that. So, for instance, like a thunderstorm coming through or a wildflower bloom that's exceptional, and kind of putting all of that into frame so that not only is your story about the landscape, but it's also about this exceptional moment in time when you got to experience that landscape.
And that is how you do that kind of photography. You park the car and you got to go walk for a bit.
Absolutely.
And go find those vistas that people haven't found before.
Every now and then I'll shoot out the window.
Well,
no, I'm just kidding.
Hey, if the light is right, you go for it. The name of the book is The National Parks, Our American Landscape, from Palace Publishing. Ian Shive, an absolute pleasure having you in here today. Good luck, by the way, with Wild Collective and everything
you
guys are doing with that.
Yeah, I really appreciate that.
And stay in touch. If you're ever in this neck of the woods, we'd love to have you back on again.
Great. Thanks so much. It's a pleasure.
That's going to wrap things up for this week's edition of Tree Huggers International. Thanks again to photographer and conservationist Ian Shive for his work with preserving America's national parks and wild areas with his photographs and activism. Ian's new book from Palace Publishing is The National Parks, Our American Landscape. And I encourage you to check out the website for Ian's new multimedia entity, Wild Collective. And that's wildcollective.com. www.wildcollective.com. And from there, you can see the Wild Exposure series, as well as the short piece called Call of the Wild that we were talking about. You can also check out Ian's own website and blog at ianshive.com. All his photographs are on there. ianshive.com. You can also find the National Parks Conservation Association online at www.npca.org. npca.org. Ian will be in Santa Barbara the weekend of December the 11th. He'll be at Santa Barbara Outfitters on State Street on Friday, December the 11th, and he'll be signing his book at the Barnes & Noble on State Street in Santa Barbara on Saturday, December the 12th. If you're along the Central Coast, pay him a visit. More information at ianshive.com. The opinions and views expressed on Tree Huggers International do not necessarily reflect the opinions and views of the staff and management of FM 94.9 or Lincoln Financial Media. And as producer, I am solely responsible for this program's content. Questions, complaints, concerns, compliments, you can go ahead and email me at tommy@fm949sd.com. For more information on Tree Huggers International and to hear previous editions of the show, find us online at the FM949 Tree Huggers International page, fm949sd.com/treehuggers. Or just go to the FM949 website and click on the Tree Huggers International logo. The new Tree Huggers International website, that'll be up soon at treehuggersintl.com. This is Tommy Howe for Tree Huggers International from the studios of KBZT FM 94.9 in San Diego. We'll be back same time next Sunday morning with another take on natural science and environmental affairs as we continue our mission to preserve parks, wildlands, and special places on Tree Huggers International. Enjoy the rest of your weekend and be well.